Hello. In recent audio snippets, we have been talking about the 10 pillars of the new American Constitution, and we have been more or less kind of caught between the 7th and the 8th pillar, the 7th pillar being the individual right to privacy, and the 8th pillar being the right to private property. And we'll hopefully continue talking about the right to property, that 8th pillar, in this audio snippet. But before proceeding with that, I felt it was important to mention a couple of things that did not get mentioned in the previous snippet. One of those things would be just a side comment on a news story that I saw the previous week, and it was about Mark Levin. He's a conservative commentator here in America. He has a radio talk show, and he's probably, as I've said to many people, I would say the most brilliant conservative thinker in America today. He's very effusive. When you listen to his talk show, he doesn't hold back. He can be very aggressive with the callers and so forth. And he speaks his mind, doesn't hold back. And he's not just effusive and emotional. He has something very interesting to say a lot of times. Very thoughtful man. And he's written many books. And they've all sold very well, especially because he focuses on history and adding a lot of detail. So it's not just a book about fluff and what he thinks about the world. He tries to back it up with historical information and so forth. And I admire his brilliance in many ways. But I am saddened by the fact that he, just like all the other conservatives, at the end of the day, is an idolater, a worshiper of the Constitution and the Founding Fathers. And I remember I used to faithfully listen to his radio shows, and on one occasion, he basically equated the Bible with the Constitution. And I don't remember the exact words, but I don't know if he actually put them at the same level, but it was almost as if, you know, the Bible is the sacred, you know, book, and number two is the Constitution, but he gave it sacred qualities in a sense that more or less put it at least right under the Bible or at the same level. And that's just an example of how conservatives have committed idolatry, you could say, in worshiping principles and writings that and people that do not deserve that type of loyalty and reverence. So the reason why I'm bringing him up is that there was this story last week. About his new book, which I think is called American Marxism, and the story focused on the fact that it was number one on Amazon's list, and it was a bit of a kind of an irony because Amazon, owned by a liberal, a diehard liberal like Bezos, has in his company's list of top-selling books this guy who is the complete opposite of what Amazon and this fellow stand for. So that was the story was a focus on the irony of that. And in a sense, it's nice to know that. Like when I read the story, it brought more sadness than happiness, a great deal more sadness, because it showed me that conservatism is very strong and alive and well, you could say, in America, but it's the type of conservatism that is not going to get us out of the mess we're in. And I haven't read the book, and I will probably never read it. I would dare say I might agree with a great deal of what is written in the book. But whatever is written in that book, based on what I know about the man, I would dare say is that the book is not going to provide solutions that are going to resolve the country's problems. So yeah, he can sell all the books he wants, and everybody, you know, who wants to read them can read them. But after reading them, they will not, they will still not have the solution to the country's problems. And I know this may sound, what I'm about to say may sound a little bit arrogant. You will be the judge, and I think history, at the end of the day, will be the judge of a statement such as the one that I'm about to make. But I will tell you categorically that what is being said in these audio snippets are the solution to America's problems. And they are the foundational principles for the establishment of a properly constituted government system that is applicable not only in America, but in any country on the face of the earth. Because what we're saying in these audio snippets are based on metaphysical principles that transcend cultural circumstances. And this is the solution. And the sad thing is no one is listening to these solutions. But this country will not recover from the disaster it's in and the purgatory it's going through until it believes in the things that are being said in these audio snippets. And I don't know if it's going to happen through these audio snippets being heard at the level that these books that Mark Levin sells are, you know, are at that level of audience and outreach, or if it's going to be someone else coming along and saying the exact same things, and maybe that other person will be sexier, more appealing in some way or another, and people will follow that person, and we will get out of this. But whoever or however it's done, it's going to be through the principles that are laid down in these audio snippets. And I know that for a fact. We will not get out of this with the DeSantis rising up and winning the White House and taking us back to conservative principles that got us into this mess to begin with. And as we've said before, over and over again, yes, the liberals are doing the destruction, but conservatives have enabled the destruction through omission, through inaction, through things that they should have done that they have refused or been unwilling or incapable of discerning that they need to do. So conservatives have sinned by inaction, and liberals have sinned by action, and a lot of it. And so we have these two sides in America. Just as a brief note, and I am digressing a little bit, but I believe it's important to point out, and we have said this before on some occasions, that the problem with the American system is that we're working with a rule book that is very, very bad. And the rule book is so ambiguous, so unclear, and so wrong in some aspects that what we've had to do is to constantly make up for its deficiencies. And when we should have a very well laid out rule book that is fundamentally sound, and then have a system of people that are applying the rule book without having to inject their own subjective personal opinion and personal tastes and interests into it, and then causing the destruction that, you know, we have now. It's just to kind of clear it up a bit. Imagine a sport where the rules are not clearly defined. If you have such a sport, then the referees, the people who act as judges on the field, on the pitch, to enforce the rules, we'll have to constantly make up rules make up for the deficiencies in the rule book. So imagine, for example, in the sport of American football, that let's say the rule says if you catch the football in the end zone, it's a touchdown. Okay, that seems clear enough. But then what happens if somebody leaps up, catches the football, and comes down on the end zone, but one foot is inside the end zone and the other foot is out of bounds? What do you call that? Is that a touchdown? Is that not a touchdown? But if the rule book doesn't say it, then the referees, when they're caught in that situation, are forced to make it up on the fly. So they have to decide, okay, it's let's say, you know, one referee will say it's 1 foot, and you know, and that will be that. And somebody will come up with a more elaborate rule that where it says that if he caught, if 1 foot came in bounds and he was that foot was in bounds for half a second, and then the other foot hit out of bounds, then it's a touchdown. But if it's more than half a second, or less than half a second later, then it's not a touchdown. So you start having to make up all these rules, and every referee will start to kind of give their own flavor of the rule, and slowly then a consensus builds up, and then people will go by precedent and say, oh, the other referee said this, so then I'll apply those rules. And it will be a touchdown under these circumstances and the other. So that's what we've had in the American system, more or less. The rule book is so bad that the referees have had to make it up as we go along. And that's where judicial activism comes in. Because judges should just be referees enforcing the rules. And if the rule book is not good enough, then what a judge should do is then and make a ruling, because he has to make a ruling right on the moment. But then point out, hey, there's something missing in a rule book. I am decreeing this verdict here, but the legislators have to go and examine the rule book and come up with something more concrete so that we can avoid this ambiguity going forward. That should be the system. But instead, what we do is tell the referees, hey, you decide because the rule book is perfect. And the referees start making up this stuff, the judges, and then we complain about what the judges are doing, but it's because we have a crappy rule book. And so we have this country divided by into liberals and conservatives, you know, two groups of idiots. And on the one hand, the liberals, they don't, whenever this thing happens, you know, where the rule book is not good enough and they have to start making up stuff, they don't want to open the floor for debate on how to fix the rule book, because the liberals' intention is to have absolute power. They want a communist government. They want a government that controls everything and everybody's lives. You know, they can call it socialism or whatever, but in reality, socialism with absolute power always degrades into communism. So let's cut the middle scenes and get to the end of the story. That's what they want. So they are not interested in re-examining the rule book and fixing it. They want to grab as much power as they can. When they see a vacuum in the rule book, they just you know, fill the vacuum with despotism, and they just keep going until they can grab as much power as they can. And then on the other hand, you have the conservatives who worship the rule book, worship the people who wrote the rule book, and therefore they wouldn't dare say, hey, maybe James Madison got it wrong. Maybe Jimmy Mann didn't know what he was doing when he wrote this in the Constitution. No, you can't do that. For crying out loud, these men are gods. They were sent by God, you know, and they came down from the mountaintop with this sacred document called the Constitution. And how dare we question their wisdom and their knowledge? Oh, they were so wise and wonderful and perfect. So in their minds, their paradigms just prevent them even examining the stupidity of some of the things that are in the Constitution. And I know that I emphasize this, the bad things in the Constitution, because that's what we have to work on. Yes, it has many good things, many good intentions, many good ideas. Yes, it was revolutionary for its time, etc., etc. Yeah, you can give it all the praises you want, but it had so many bad things. That's what we have to focus on, and that's why I speak so ill, in such an ill way about it, because we have to break that worship and focus on what we have to correct. And then we can then look back historically and say, oh yeah, give them a little bit of praise and say, oh, that was wonderful, but still be aware of everything that was wrong with that document. So the conservatives never want to go back and fix the rule book. And what they say, the excuse is, oh, the founding fathers could not have envisioned this happening. You know, like the example of abortion. There were no abortions going on in the 1700s. So how could they have written something into the Constitution? How could they have imagined that man would degrade to the level of killing fetuses and all this and that? And then I always go back to the same thing. You always say that they were wise men who knew how corrupt man could be. That's one of the things conservatives always bring up about the founding fathers. Well, if they knew how bad man could be, why didn't they kind of envision that we would end up in a situation like that or anything close to it? Because as we've said, the Constitution does not protect the right to life of the born. How can it be possibly used in any way, shape, or form to protect the life of the unborn if the born are not protected? And yes, people, and you can't argue that born people didn't exist in the 1700s. Everybody was born in this world from the beginning of human history. And you can't say, you know, born people were never killed back in the 1700s, you know, that sort of started happening later. No, people were getting killed back in the 1700s, and still they did not bother to include the right to life. And so the conservatives keep arguing, oh, the founding fathers didn't envision this. As wise as they were not living in times as we have now, where people were doing the things that are being done now, and therefore that's why they didn't include it in the Constitution. So they put that argument in their head, and that just blocks out everything else. And then their solution is, oh, let's just add another amendment. Let's just add another law. Let's just go ahead and be political activists and try to get DeSantis into the White House, and let's try to get all these non-rhino conservative Republicans elected into the House and the Senate, and then we can fix the problem. So what they do is they try to patch up a system that is fundamentally flawed, and they just add another Band-Aid to it, and that's their solution, because they never want to go back and revisit the original document and say, okay, we have to fix it from the ground up. Yeah, take the good ideas, the good things that were there, the good intentions, but let's rewrite the whole thing in a proper way so that the rights of individuals are properly protected, so that we can have a government that allows people to be free to act responsibly and to produce and prosper and live. But no, we can't do that, because that would mean acknowledging that Jimmy Madd, you know, that's my way of saying James Madison, that Jimmy Madd was wrong, and that Thomas Jefferson didn't know what he was doing in some ways and so forth. No, we can't have that. So that's why the rule book never gets rewritten, because on the one hand, we have people who don't want to have a debate about the rule book, because they want to have no rules controlling their actions. And then on the other hand, we have people who worship the writers of the rule book and are never willing to go back and correct it. So yeah, you know, kudos, I guess, in a sarcastic way to Mark Levin, if he's selling all these books. And I don't envy him in that way. That's not what I'm trying to say here. But it saddens me that Americans are investing into ideas that are dead. And the ideas that will save the nation are being said in these audio snippets, and no one is really paying attention, because they just the people who should be listening to this are still trapped in paradigms that block them from really embracing what needs to be done. So that was one thing I wanted to mention, and I know it's unrelated technically to the things we're discussing in these audio snippets, but I believe it had to be said. And now another side comment I wanted to mention that I didn't get to say in the previous snippet was regarding a Law and Order episode that I was mentioning. And in this Law and Order episode, as you may recall if you listened to the previous snippet, there was this guy who had AIDS. It's a show from the 1980s, early 90s, I guess, when the AIDS epidemic was still kind of big on in the news, in the news cycle. And in this story, this man, young guy, had AIDS, and he was deliberately sleeping with women, as many women as he could, in an effort to infect and kill off and take with him as many, you know, women as he could. So the whole story was about stopping this man. And at some point, they needed to access health records to finally identify him. And they went to the health department, I guess, in New York State, because the show is based in New York City, the storylines, and the filming was done in New York City. And so in the story, these two cops show up at the health department asking the health department employee for information to get the name of this person, because they had enough clues to get the name. They just needed the health department to provide it for them. And the health department employee kept saying, no, this is, doctor-patient confidentiality is protected by medical privacy laws. And they were able to get a judge to force the health department employee, health department people to give out the name. And but then another judge in the episode overruled the previous judge and threw out the evidence that was gathered through that avenue. And then that was appealed. And at some point, I remember in the episode, this panel who was listening to this decision, to this case, and then at the end, a decision was made, and this judge was speaking, and she was saying, well, we have to respect the right to privacy of people, but sometimes we have to defend the common good, and that's when the right to privacy has to kind of take a backseat. But what bothered me about the phrase was common good. So in other words, eventually this person in this, you know, fictitious episode was stopped because the common good of people, you know, their lives, was more important than his medical right to privacy. And the problem with that is not that the right to privacy was violated, because as we've said, that's one of the problems in the American system. The right to privacy is so poorly defined, and it's just basically kind of embedded in the Fourth Amendment, I believe, and a little bit in the Third Amendment. And it's so ambiguous or poorly defined that we have allowed it to grow into something that protects wrongdoing. And we've said, for example, in the case of a married couple, a husband can tell the wife that, you know, he killed 17 women, and he can tell the wife where all the bodies are buried, and the authorities cannot force the woman to testify against her husband because it's protected by the marriage confidentiality and all that. And so the right to privacy has become this shield to protect people from being judged for the wrongdoing. So the right to privacy should be clearly defined in the Constitution that it only pertains to the shame of vulnerability and nakedness, in other words, weakness, personal weakness, and things that that embarrass us. Not things that are necessarily wrong, but things that are embarrassing to us. That's what the right to privacy should protect. The right to have a space where we can undress ourselves, in a sense, and be vulnerable without the risk of public scrutiny or shame. That's what the right to privacy should protect, but not the right to wrongdoing. So nakedness is not wrong necessarily. And when we confuse nakedness with wrongdoing, then the right to privacy gets muddled and we get into a mess. So in this case, it was, you know, there was no right to privacy to protect in this fictitious episode. But it was the right to privacy, as we understand it in the current American system, was overwritten by the intent to protect the common good. And that phrase is so dangerous, because the problem in that episode was not that he was killing a lot of people. If he could just kill one person, and that's all he did, one person, no one else, then the right to privacy, as we understand it, should not apply. But the problem is when we start saying, oh, he had to be stopped for the common good, that becomes a recipe for disaster when we think of things in those terms. So why do we have that situation? Because in the American system, the concept of the right of the individual is never really clearly defined. If you do wrong to one person, that's enough for the system to come down on you. That should be enough. You don't have to go be a mass murderer and do a lot of harm to the common good, to the public in general, to be punished. But because the concept of individuality is so not present in our system, then this judge in this imaginary episode had to appeal to a higher concept of the common good. Yeah, you know, we have to save lives, the lives of the community. But it should not have mattered. It should not matter that we have to protect future killings. We have to deal with the people he has already, you know, injected with the virus knowingly to kill them. And if he only infected one person, that should be enough for the right to privacy to be ignored. And I just wanted to mention that thing, the common good. Whenever you hear people talking about the common good, just your ear should perk up and say, oh, okay, problem. You know, like, you know, the old Lost in Space episodes, you know, you should start going danger, danger, danger. Because that's a code word for, okay, we need to suppress the right of the individual to protect the community. And that's what that judge was basically saying. We need to protect his inherent right to privacy to protect everybody else. And that should never happen. The rights of the individual should never be conditioned by what is better for the community. You know, it's like saying, for example, we have a society where they want to sacrifice a virgin once a year because that appeases the gods in their religion. So they need to do this. And let's say that some enlightened leader comes along and says, hey, we're going to stop the virgin sacrifices. And then people get upset and, you know, they hire BLM and they start rioting and looting and doing all these bad things because they are upset that their virgin sacrifices have been stopped. And then somebody says, hey, you know what, I think we're going to have to bring them back. The virgin sacrifices, because the right to life of that virgin is not as important as protecting the common good. You know, property is being destroyed. You know, businesses are being torched, and some people are getting killed. Cars are being destroyed by these mobs, and business is suffering, and the economy is tanking because people are upset that they are not allowed to kill the virgin, and so the right of this individual has to be suppressed for the common good. That is the problem. No, the thing should be, if my right, the exercise of my right, infringes on the right of another individual, not the common good, another individual, then we have to stop you as a society, or as, you know, personal individuals. It's the right of an individual oppressing the right of the individual of another person. Everything should be viewed from the prism of individuals, not this mass collective concept that, yeah, the rights of the many are more important than the rights of the few. No. The rights of every individual is important. And if one individual's right is suppressed, then we should get involved. Because then it becomes a democratic thing. If a vast majority of people want to kill the virgin once a year, we have to go ahead and do it. So that collective thinking is very dangerous. So whenever you hear the word the phrase common good, your ears should perk up. And as I said, you should start doing like the Lost in Space robot and go danger, 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 because that's a sign of somebody opening the door for the violation of individual rights. Okay, so now that we've said these things, let's get back to the topic and at hand, which is the right to property, which would be the eighth pillar of the Constitution. And we said before that one of the things that should be underlined under the right to property in the new American Constitution is the right to acquire property through work or effort, with the emphasis on work or effort. So if I produce through my work and my effort something, then I have an inherent right to have possession of what I worked for. A worker is worthy of his wages. And that contrasts with the socialist concept that liberals have, where they see the right to property as the right to claim stuff, you know, like a right to a free education. So that means that if you get into all these student debt, then the government should pay for it and you should be okay. And like we were discussing before, the polio boy, which is my name for FDR, and FDR, as you may know, is the initials for Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But to me, FDR really means the fast decline of the Republic, because it was under his presidency that we began the full-blown downhill decline of the country. When he gave his last state of address in 1944, shortly before he died and went to hell the next year, he spoke about the Second Bill of Rights, that we needed to rewrite. So there was this guy who was planning to rewrite the book, the rule book, but it was like rewriting it to fit more his agenda. He was more than just trying to fix it. He was trying to replace it with another rule book, in a sense. And in the Second Bill of Rights, so quote unquote, he was including things like the right to a home. And as we were saying before, what the hell does that mean? I have a right to a home. If I have a right to something, I'm entitled to it without doing anything. That's basically a right. If I have the right to life, I don't have to work to acquire the right to life. I'm born with it. If I have the right to property, I have the inherent right to acquire property. It's not something that I have to earn. So if I have the right to a home, according to Polio Boy, who's burning in hell as we speak, then that means that just by me existing, somebody should provide me with a house. And that's not the right to property. It's not the right to someone else's property. It's not the right to benefit from someone else's work or effort just because some government authority has decreed it as such. So So that's what the first principle is about, the right to acquire property through work or effort, not just to acquire property, period, or full stop. So that was number one. The second sub-principle under this eighth pillar, we said, was the right to acquire property through an honest exchange of goods and services. And that means the right that to, you know, produce something through my work and effort and then sell it off to somebody else in exchange for something that I want from the other person. So two people have properties. Someone has property A, somebody has property B, and then they can exchange that, you know, property. You know, property B goes to one guy and property A goes to the other guy. That honest exchange. And it has to be clearly honest. In other words, that I can't give you A in exchange for B, to acquire B, if I am saying that A does something that it really doesn't do. You know, like somebody's selling you a toaster oven that really doesn't toast anything, but you buy it under the assumption that it works, and then when you turn it on or try to turn it on, it doesn't do anything. That is not an honest exchange. So consumer protections and all that would automatically fit into this principle that the government should ensure that the exchange of goods and services is honest. Now, if you bought a broken toaster oven and you knew it was broken, that is your problem. Then it's your thing. You wanted to buy a broken toaster, that's your thing. But as long as you were properly informed, that's fine. But this principle, I'm calling it the Commerce Clause. This will be the Commerce Clause of the new American Constitution. And speaking of the Commerce Clause, I think it's important to kind of point out what the Commerce Clause is as we currently stand with the current broken system. The Commerce Clause, if I'm not mistaken, is in Article 1, Section 8 of the current broken Constitution, and it gives the federal government the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and also among the states and with the Indian tribes. I really don't know how that applies nowadays, the part about the Indian tribes, but let's focus a little bit on the other parts. And so the federal government can control commerce with other countries. And it can control activities that pertain to commerce between the states. So interstate commerce is regulated by the federal government, is able to be regulated because of this Commerce Clause, which is Article 1, Section 8, if I'm not mistaken. Now, this Commerce Clause, for those of you outside the U.S., has been constantly misused in an effort to enlarge the socialist agenda. It's like because the Constitution is so limited in what people can, the government can or cannot do, and again, it's not because it's limiting so that it benefits us. As individuals, that the government cannot do all these things. No, the problem is it just doesn't say what to do. Things that need to be said are not said. That is the problem. And as we've said before, the Constitution says, okay, this is what the federal government can do or whatever. But then it just leaves it open-ended for the state government so we can get oppressed in a more complete way by the state government. And we're not protected by the federal government. And conservatives, for some reason, seem to think that's okay. So the thing is, the Commerce Clause has been a tool that socialists have tried to use to promote their agenda, and it's also been used for good things. But it's just a reflection of the fact that we have such a bad rule book that we have to make up stuff as we go along to get things done. And sometimes that opens the door for bad things, you know, getting done. And Polio Boy, FDR, tried to use the Commerce Clause a lot to promote his New Deal agenda. In other words, it just gave this entryway into the federal government being able to control the exchange of things between people. If somehow they can prove that that there is a interstate thing going on in that exchange, then the federal government can step in and try to do something. So it seemed to be like this open door for government power. And in the civil rights era of the 1960s, this was the Commerce Clause was very important. In Title II of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, they put in a clause that outlawed discrimination based on color, religion, or national origin in hotels, motels, restaurants, theaters, and all other public accommodations that were engaged in interstate commerce. You know, that's how sad it was that we had to take this Commerce Clause that, you know, was about something else completely and take it and try to use it in such a way that we could try to put an end to segregation and racial oppression of individuals in the South. You know, because as you may know, back in the 1960s in the South, they had segregated restaurants, and some black people could not, take a room in some hotels because they were for whites only. So some people would travel, to a state and try to get a room in that hotel, and they wouldn't be allowed because it was for whites only. So the 1964 Civil Rights Act tried to end that. And they said, okay, if you're a hotel, you're kind of engaged in interstate commerce because you have people coming from another state to do business with you. And that was kind of the entry door that they used to then justify the federal government being able to force Southerners to finally respect the rights of black people. So that's an example of how it was tried to be used in a proper way. But it, instead of people saying, hey, you know, there's something wrong with this whole system where we have to kind of take this Commerce Clause and artificially use it for something that was really not its original intent. You know, there's something wrong with it. Let's go and fix it. Instead of that, we just try to kind of work around the limitations and twist ourselves into a pretzel to get things done. I just needed to mention the way the Commerce Clause is understood currently and under the current American Constitution, but we will have a more straightforward Commerce Clause, much more open-ended, but not about not giving the government the right to do things. It's giving the people the right to do things. Our new Commerce Clause will be that we can engage in the free exchange, honest exchange of goods and services, and the government cannot, when they start infringing on that right to commerce, then they are beginning to infringe on our right to property. And the third thing that the third principle under the right to property, this eighth pillar, is the right to gift your property to whomever you please. And we can call that the charity clause. If I want to give my house away to some person that I don't even know, that's my right to do so. And the government cannot say, no, you cannot do that. And when they start putting penalties or excessive restrictions on that, then that's a hint that one's right to property is being infringed upon. And a fourth principle we had mentioned was the right not to transfer your properties to someone else for a price that you do not deem fair. So if somebody is saying, hey, I'm going to buy your car and I'm going to give you $50 for it. And you go, no, this is not worth $50. If you want my car, you'll have to pay me a lot more than that. The government, the authority, if it's a true authority, cannot come and say, no, you have to give it for $50. Or, for example, it's a car that has a lot of sentimental value to you, and some millionaire guy collector comes and sees your car and says, I'll give you $1 million for it. And maybe technically it's not worth $1 million, but in your heart it's worth $1 million because that's how valuable the car is in sentimental value. And you go, no, I'm not going to sell it for $5 million, or even if you give me $1 billion, I will not sell you my car. The government cannot say, no, you'll have to give it to him. No, but it's important to me. No, I don't care. $1 million is more than fair amount for that piece of garbage that you're driving, and you will have to give your car away. That is an example of violation of the right to property. If I want to keep it, I should be able to keep it, and no one should be forcing me to give it away if I don't want to. If I don't deem the price to be fair, that's why it's my property. That means I can keep it as long as I want. And that deal has to do, or kind of clashes with the eminent domain clause. And I apologize if I use the phrase as if I should expect everyone to know what that means. But outside of America, the concept of eminent domain is known by different terms. Like I think in India and Malaysia and Singapore, you know, places like that in that part, eastern part of the world, of Asia, it's known like by the term land acquisition or something like that. In the UK and Ireland and Australia, New Zealand, countries like that, you might know it by the term compulsory purchase or compulsory acquisition or resumption or some term like that. And I think resumption is the term used in Hong Kong and in countries like Uganda and places like that. So it has different names, and basically it is the right of the government to take property away from you. In some countries, I think it's called expropriation. In other countries, it's called appropriation. But basically, it's just the government being able to take your property away from you. We have that in the American system under the Fifth Amendment, and it's called the Takings Clause. The Fifth Amendment is a very sad amendment. It's just three lines. If you when they show like the handwritten version of the Constitution, it's just like three lines, so it's very brief, but it's chock full of good and very bad things, very, very bad things. And I think we'll have an audio snippet hopefully one day about the Fifth Amendment and talk about everything that's wrong with it. It has some good things, but most of it is just an open door to a whole bunch of bad things. And one of the open doors to a whole bunch of bad things is the Takings Clause. And it's the part of that brief amendment that says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. And I'm glad that James Madison chose to add that just compensation part. Because in some countries, there is no restriction. If the government really wants your property, they can just take it away from you. And they're not restricted by the need to compensate you in a just way. And it's also interesting that he used the phrase public use. And apparently he didn't want to use a phrase like, public good or common good or public benefit, because that opened the door maybe to other things. I don't even know, what benefit there is in using the term public use. I guess it just doesn't invite you to take things away from people for the common good, in a sense. But it's still open-ended. And what does it mean, just compensation? That's also a little bit ambiguous. But basically, it's saying, I want your house. I'm the federal government. I want your house, and I need it. I don't care how much you love it. I'm just going to give you the fair market value for it. And what if my house is very important to me? That's where I grew up in, a lot of sentimental value. Then the government can say, the hell with your sentimental value. I don't give a rodent's derriere what you like, how much you love that house, and that you wouldn't sell it for $1 million. We're going to give you $300,000 because that's the fair market value, and deal with it. So that's the Takings Clause. And that should have never been allowed in the Constitution. And just as a side note, Thomas Jefferson wanted a little bit of a more radical kind of detachment from the government, being able to possess and control lands, and he wanted what I believe to be called what is called allodial ownership, and I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, allodial or allodial ownership. And we have to take this whole thing in the context, in the historical context. As you know, back in the Middle Ages, in Europe, they had manors, and there was a lord of the manor, and he would, in this feudal system, he would kind of give land to serfs, and they would work the land. The land was the manor's land, the lord's land, but these people were kind of like using it as if it was theirs, and they had to pay the lord of the manor a hefty fee for being able to use the land that belonged to him. And that was kind of the feudal system, and we slowly began to move away from that, and by the 1800s we were more or less kind of away from that system. But what happened in America was that as people came from England to America, they were granted land by the crown. So the crown would, you know, the monarch in England would say, "Hey, I'm giving, you know, Lord Calvert or whatever, Lord Baltimore, the right to this patch of land in the New World," which eventually became the, you know, the state of Maryland. So the land, the state of Maryland, kind of belonged technically to this Lord Calvert, I forget his name, or Lord Baltimore, and the land belonged to him, and he was kind of basically giving it out to the people who were living there, and so it was kind of like a feudal system revisited. And Thomas Jefferson wanted to get away from that whole allocation of land, and he wanted an allodial system. An allodial ownership means ownership of, you know, property, real estate property, that is independent of any superior landlord. So in other words, when you get an allodial title to a land, it means that you have absolute ownership of the land, and you're not subject to any rent, any service, or any acknowledgement to any superior. You know, just like in the feudal system, where I'm using the land; it's kind of like my land, but I have to acknowledge someone superior and give him part of my proceeds. And Thomas Jefferson wanted an allodial system where that was over, where it's my land, and I don't have to pay a fee, I don't have to pay a rent, I don't have to pay anything. It's my land. It's completely under my control. Jimmy Madd didn't want to go that far, so he kind of did this compromise, and that's why he introduced the takings clause, where he said the government, the government can demand land from you. It's not completely yours. You are still accountable to this government that can take it away from you. And now the thing is that we in the current system in America, what we have is what's called fee simple, fee, F-E-E, simple. And the word fee is a bit confusing, because it's really actually a derivation of the word fief, as in feudal landholding. So fee simple means the absence of any temporal condition limiting the duration of ownership. So that means, okay, the land is yours. It's fee simple ownership. It's simply yours. But it doesn't mean that you are not accountable to a superior power. You're still subject to taxation. You're subject to compulsory purchase, i.e. eminent domain, or police power. The police can come and kind of take over your land if they need to take it over for some reason. So it's kind of an allodial ownership, but with some conditions attached to it. You're still accountable to a higher authority. And that's why that's kind of the root behind which we have the property tax, which we have explained in previous snippets, that that should be unconstitutional because it violates basic taxation principles that will be in the new American Constitution that are destructive to the economy, to the rights of the individual. That's what we have, a fee simple system in America, and that's why we're still forced to pay property taxes to this authority, as if the government ceded the land to us like this big lord of this big manor, and he's, you know, kindly letting us use our land, and we have to pay a property tax fee to the lord of the manor. When you put it that way, because that's exactly what it is, it becomes evident that this ain't right. We shouldn't be in a manor feudal system where the lord of the manor now, instead of being this rich aristocrat, is actually a government. That is wrong, and we shouldn't have that. And also, we can have our property taken away from us if the government needs it. Yeah, they'll give us fair market value, whatever the hell, pardon my French, that means. It doesn't matter what value I assign to that property. It's what they decide for me. And so that would go away under the new American Constitution with this right that you can't be forced to transfer your property to anyone else, whether it be the government or another individual or a company or whatever, if the price ain't right. If the price is not what I think is right, then I have allodial ownership of this land. This is mine. I'm not subject to anyone else. And you would say, oh, well, that's not right, because then what if we need something and we need to build a highway and it has to go through this land to be cheaper and for the common good, we have to, you know, the right of the individual has to die at the expense of the right of the common good. No. If you can't build a highway, through that property, then you'll have to build around the property or not build a highway at all. And that's just the way it is. And yes, the guy's going to get a lot of flack, a lot of criticism by his neighbors. Oh, you know, you evil guy, the highway couldn't be built because of you. We hate you. And, you know, he will suffer the social consequences of that. But the land is his. He can do whatever he wants with it. That should be inherent in the Constitution. The concept eminent domain should have never been put into the system. And just as a side note, many people don't realize this, but the U.S. federal government owns about 640 million acres of land. The federal government owns 640 million acres of land. And for those of you who are more metric oriented, 640 million acres is about 259 hectares. And to me, hectares, acres, everything else like that is kind of like terms that have no meaning to me, because I didn't grow up in a rural environment, so I have no idea what an acre feels like in terms of size. But a hectare, that kind of makes a little more sense to me. A hectare is think of a city block that is 100 meters by 100 meters. And for those of you who don't know what 100 meters is like, that's about 110 yards. And if that's still not clear to you, then just think of an American football field plus the end zone, which is 10 yards. That's 110 yards. That's 100 meters. That's what Jesse Owens ran in the 1936 Olympics. If you still don't know what 100 meters is like, then I can't do anything for you then. So 100 meters by 100 meters, think of a square of that size. That's a hectare. And put together 259 million of those hectares, of those blocks, of those squares. That's how much land the federal government owns, which is about 28% of the total land area of the country. I think the land area of the whole country is about 2.3 billion acres, and 28% of that is what the federal government owns. And I personally blame Teddy Roosevelt for the excessive ownership of the federal government of our land. If you look in a map of how that colors the areas that are owned by the federal government, you will see that the vast majority of it is on the western side of the country, and if you paint it federal land red, most of the land is red. It's amazing how red the western side of the U.S. would be if you painted federal government red on the map. It's almost as if they own almost all the West. And I personally blame that for why the West has remained in many ways underdeveloped. We could be much more productive on the western side of the U.S. if that land was not being controlled by the federal government. And Teddy Roosevelt has a lot to blame that is assignable to him for that, because Teddy Roosevelt, who was the president from, let's say, 1901 to 1909, or 1900 to 1908, if you prefer multiples of four, because we get our elections are every 4 years, every multiple of four. If the year is a multiple of four, there's going to be an election in November or at the end of the year, and then the winner of the election takes over at the start of the next year. So I always prefer to think in terms of multiples of four. It's easier for me. But so if you think of it in that way, he was elected. He was president around between 1900 and 1908. I believe he was not elected in 1900. I think he someone else got elected, and they kicked the bucket, and Teddy Roosevelt was the vice president, and he took over. But for all intents and purposes, he was the president at the start of the 20th century in the country. During that time, he set aside more federal land, national parks, and national preserves than all of his predecessors combined. He issued, there's a page on Wikipedia listing all the executive actions, in other words, either executive orders or what they call proclamations that he did, to grab federal land. And I had to count it, and I had to scroll and scroll and scroll, and I might have lost count, but my final total was 171. Executive orders or proclamations, 171 by Teddy Roosevelt to appropriate land for federal ownership in the West. And his intent was conservation. He was a strong conservationist and all that. And yeah, that's all nice and good. It goes to the principle that we shared before, the sixth pillar of the right to life, that in the Constitution should include the concept of protecting the right to life of animals. Silly and ridiculous as that may sound, that is fundamentally important. And so there's nothing wrong with conservationism and protecting wildlife and all that, but I think he took it too far, and to the point that, why did he have the power to execute 171 orders to do that? Where did he acquire the power to do that? And a lot of his executive actions were contested in court, so he was constantly being attacked for that. But it still goes back to the same issue we've been saying in this audio snippet. We see that this guy had a need to do this thing. He went ahead and did it because there was nothing in the rule book that either said he could or couldn't do it. And so he just went ahead and did it, and we all saw him doing it, and no one said, okay, we have to really kind of get it clear in our heads. Does the Constitution allow it, or does it not allow it? And it goes back to the debate, is it a strict interpretation or non-strict interpretation? If we had a strict interpretation the way the purest conservatives would want, then the government wouldn't be able to do anything, and the state governments would be able to oppress us at all levels. So in practicality, it doesn't work because the rule book is so bad. So instead of examine, seeing that as an example, hey, we have to go back and re-examine the rule book on what the executive branch can do, because that's another problem in the Constitution. We'll do another audio snippet on that someday, hopefully, to show how badly defined the executive branch is in the American Constitution. So if a president could only do what's in the Constitution, he wouldn't be doing anything. It'd be an empty, practically an empty office, and an empty suit that would be there. Instead of going back and re-examining what can a president do or not do, is a president allowed to do all these executive orders? What's going on here? Instead of that, we just let it happen. And then we get upset that 100 years later, you had the monster from Uganda, from Kenya, coming and issuing all these destructive executive mandates. And then now we complain when we had 100 years to think about it, and we never did. So I think the snippet has run very, very long, and but I think we were able to mention most of the things we wanted to mention in this snippet, and we'll continue, hopefully, with the right to property, the eighth pillar of the new American Constitution, in the next audio snippet. Thank you very much.